For NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. I'm here with Robin Hilton. Back in the summer of 2015, Roger Waters did something at the time I found surprising. He played the Newport Folk Festival. I couldn't imagine a man whose music felt more distant to folk music than Pink Floyd's, than Roger Waters. And then when he got on stage, he played John Prine's Hello in There, a song about aging and why we fight and die in war. And it all became clear. These are both men, John Prine and Roger Waters, both men covering the same ground, just different textures and layers to tell the same story. So we asked Roger Waters to play DJ, to play music by those he loved, and talk about what draws him to a song. This conversation isn't about his time with Pink Floyd. In fact, over the course of this nearly hour-long interview, he didn't mention the band he left nearly 30 years ago, even once. We do talk with him about his upcoming own solo work, including his upcoming tour called Us and Them. But at the heart of everything, the creative force behind some of 20th century's most iconic music is politics, money, greed, and ultimately hope. Mention Billie Holiday, and the conversation goes somewhere other than music. In fact, that's what happened. We were playing a Billie Holiday song before he walked in the door, God Bless a Child. Roger Waters sits down. He's in L.A. We're in Washington, D.C. And, well, here's how it unfolded.
A little settling in music.
Them that's got shall get, them that's not shall lose.
I think every time someone walks in the room, they should hear this, or something as good as this.
They sure should. Lady Day.
When was the first time you heard Billie Holiday? You recall?
I have no idea. I mean, when I was a young teenager, for sure. I used to go to a friend's house, and I used to climb down the drainpipe to escape from 42 Rock Road, and I would go round to Cherry Hinton Road to Mrs. O'Connell's house, and I would sit up with her son, Seamus, and my friend Andrew Rawlinson, all night, and she would cook us boiled potatoes, being a good Irish woman. And we would listen to this, among so much other jazz and blues and all kinds of music.
Let's listen a little more. It sounds wonderful. How old were you when you were climbing down that drain pipe?
15.
Mm-hmm. And,
16,
and the year roughly would have been?
58, 59.
I even wonder, as an American 15-year-old, it's not common, at least back then, to have heard Billie Holiday. And yet, there you are.
And, and Billie Holiday, Bessie Smith, Hudi Ledbetter, but also a lot of Dixieland jazz, King Creole, Kid Ory, Johnny Dodds, Bix Beiderbecke. And we were listening to modern jazz as well. We were listening to Thelonious Monk and Art Blakey and a very, very Catholic tastes, you know, Johnny Hodges. Lots of Ellington. I mean, just tons and tons of good music. No pop music. Well, very, very little pop music.
That's an unusual thing for a kid in the 50s. You'd think Lonnie Donegan, you'd think, you know.
Yeah, we didn't. I mean, obviously I was aware of Lonnie Donegan. How could you forget? Does your chewing gum lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight? What a remarkable lyric.
But he did a great Rock Island Line, which is right in
He your, did do your, a good Rock Island Line, yeah.
In your vein there. I'm here with Robin Hilton, who hasn't yet spoken, but...
Hey, Robin.
How you doing?
Good.
You know, I was listening to that Billie Holiday. There's another version that's much slower than that. It was, but the one we played, was that what you think of when you think of...
Listen, that's close enough for rock and roll. For an old rock and roller, that's close enough. What a wonderful voice and what a communicator of emotion. She's all over that Johann Hari book, Chasing the Scream. Do you know that book?
I don't.
Okay.
Tell me or tell us.
It's a book, I think it's called The Beginning and the End of the War on Drugs. So it's a kind of history of everything that happened after the Harrison Act in 1914 in the United States and how it has degenerated, the situation has degenerated to the point that we're at now where we're just beginning to turn the corner following the lead of great world leaders like Portugal and Uruguay who recognized that the criminalization of the possession of narcotics is hugely detrimental to society in every possible way. And anyway, you know, Billie Holiday was persecuted so horrifically and with such venom back in the day, and they killed her eventually.
When you say they killed her?
They locked her up. They locked her to a bed and killed her. That's what they did. They killed her. They made it impossible for her to live because she was a junkie, and instead of treating her in the way that, in my view, junkies should be treated, which is what they're doing in Switzerland now. They've cleaned Zurich particularly up completely.
By doing what?
Well, by saying, listen, if you want your junk, you have to come to the office and we'll inject you there and then on the spot. But you have to talk to somebody for 10 minutes before you go out. So suddenly these people who were, you know, stealing television sets and living rough and covered all over the train stations and public parks and things, they're back in society. They have jobs. They become useful members of society again. And the fact that they're addicted to an opiate just becomes a minor irritation in the process and progress of their lives, because the state has recognized that the worst thing that you can do is to criminalize their addiction and to force them into antisocial behaviors and to clog up your penal system and all the rest of it. Johann Hari's book, I would thoroughly recommend it.
Thanks. Don't know it at all. Are the laws in England similar to what they would be in the U.S.?
No, they're less draconian in England, but marginally. I think it's maybe an upshot of the economic policies that we've all maintained in most of the Western world. Obviously not in the northeastern bits of Europe, but certainly in the United States and the UK, where we have allowed, you know, the unmentionable few to dictate the way all our lives have lived. And in consequence, we've created an enormously larger underclass of disaffected young people than were there before. Because there's no work for anybody, because we're not interested really in the social construct of our society. We're interested in the profit margin for the very, very few people who own everything.
It feels so true, but not completely true. I don't think that, I mean, not every politician is got that mission in their lives that it's profit and it's...
Well, certainly Bernie Sanders doesn't seem to here. You know, as I'm constantly saying, he seemed to be the only honest voice in the whole weird charade that is your current presidential election. There were others who have a sane voice, but they're not standing. Elizabeth Warren, I would pick out, and I'm sure there are many others in the body politic, but I'm sure they're also that they're a tiny minority. Most of your representatives and congressmen and senators have been bought and paid for many years ago, and it's all completely understood that they are like poodles wandering around with collars around their necks, and they just do as they're told.
You had a good deal of fun in your show last night. Do you want to describe what unfolded?
Yeah, I have a bit of a whack at Donald Trump. Who doesn't? Everybody does. He's fair game, and he's a very, very safe target, you know, Donald Trump, because everybody, or almost everybody, recognizes he's a nincompoop. But he's a very dangerous nincompoop, you know, because he is crazy and he's very, very bigoted and racist. He's a fascist, obviously. He's a white supremacist. He's the most extreme form of nationalism. You could call it national Trumpism, and you wouldn't be far from the truth. So He's a very soft target, Donald Trump.
I've been continually surprised and amazed over the decades of listening to Pink Floyd, how much of that music, especially from The Wall, has continued to resonate. And you keep thinking, maybe this won't be as relevant anymore, and it continues to be relevant.
Yeah, it does. Well, the last solo album I made, Amused to Death, which was 23 years ago, if we can believe that now, is even more relevant than The Wall. But The Wall, obviously, is much, much older. I am making a new record now, which I hope will be relevant, too. We will see.
How about if I play a bit of Amused to Death? Does that work for you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Cold enough, out in the valley, warm and clean, the little ones sit by the TV screen. No thoughts to think, no tears to cry. All so dry, down to the very last breath. What's wrong with me? Why am I so out of breath? The captain said, excuse me, ma'am, the species has amused itself to death.
Amused itself to death.
It has amused itself to death.
Amused itself to death.
We did as we were told, we weren't sold. It was the greatest show on earth, but then it was over. We ignored, we drove our racing cars. We ate our last few jars of caviar. And somewhere out there in the stars, a keen-eyed lookout spied a flickering light. And when they found our shadows, go grab the TV set. They ran down every lead, they repeated every test. They checked out all the data on the list. But then the alien anthropologists admitted they were still breaks. But on eliminating every other reason for that sad demise, they learned the only.
It's hard to pull the fader here. it's really good. When you were at Newport Folk Festival, you played a song called Crystal Clear Brooks.
Yeah.
My Morning Jacket was your backup band. It was a poem about the children of Gaza.
No, it's not about the children of Gaza. It's about the children of everywhere.
Okay.
It's about our responsibility to pass on a land that still has crystal clear brooks for them to go fishing in. But it's all our children. It's not restricted to Gaza, though, as you know, I have a deep compassion for the 1.6 million people who live in the open-air prison that we call Gaza, waiting each day to be slaughtered afresh. But no, that's for all our children. When the time comes and the last day dawns, and the air of the piper warms the crags of the high country, and the holy writ blows like burned paper away, and wise men concede that there's more than one way, more than one path, more than one book, more than one fisherman. It goes on. Yeah, it's about that.
Actually, I'm going to play the Sam Cooke song, and then I want to talk about how music can make a change.
Yeah.
It's a song that you want to play. It's just one of the great songs of all time.
Here we go. It is.
In a little tent
just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
I think that song made a big dent on people's thoughts and lives in the middle 1960s. Do you think songs still do that? You certainly try.
I think songs have the potential to do that without any question. I mean, they on an individual level, they touch us individually. Good songs do. And they change our lives personally. Whether many songs come around that have an effect on the way society works and upon our gestalt values and upon our racism, obviously, and other factors, I'm not so sure. I think it's less easily for that to happen these days than maybe it was 50 years ago.
Do you think it's a quantity of stuff or the fact that everybody's not listening to the same songs or...
I think that the business factions in the music industry and maybe all other industries as well have figured out how to make what the songs are about less relevant and less important. It's an inconvenience to business if songs are actually about anything.
But the gatekeepers that would have kept a song like that, for example, or the Sam Cooke "A Change Is Gonna Come" off the airwaves, they don't exist anymore. Anybody can put out anything. I'm surprised you said
that. Well, it's very interesting you should say that, because it sounds almost as if you've been sucked into the notion that we're freer than we were. We're not. In fact, music no longer has any value. It is only around in our lives because it's used to sell soap powder and Volkswagens.
But I don't turn that on. Why does it, that doesn't affect me. If I don't turn on the TV or watch movies.
No, but what you have to understand is when you listen to iTunes or Spotify or Pandora or maybe not Netflix, because you actually have to pay, don't you, if you watch a movie or something?
Netflix.
You don't have to pay to listen to music, and most people don't. So the idea that Spotify, for instance, is about advertising stuff. They get their income not from subscriptions to music channels, which get paid on to the artists who've made the recordings that they can choose or listen to. They get it from the advertisers. So it's the advertisers who are actually driving the ship. And there's a lot of talk in the high end of Silicon Valley about, why are we actually based in a country? We should be on an offshore platform somewhere so we don't have to pay any taxes. We don't actually have to take any part in the running of society for the people who make up the society, for the citizens in the United States, for instance, or any other country. They become autonomous units that are there to channel money out of the pockets of the general public into their pockets. Music is just a means to the end for them, so that they don't have the passion for Billie Holiday or Sam Cooke or any of the other people that I might choose and who I really care about listening to. Those people, under these new rules, would never get paid, because the idea of all of this, it's all there for everybody to stream all the time. is based upon the notion that it is valueless and that the people who make the music should not get paid. And they say, well, they do pay them. Yeah, they pay them like 0.00004 of 1 cent for a stream or something. The change that actually goes into the pocket of the artist is minuscule. There's no way that young artists particularly can make a living, which I think is disgusting. You know, why would you know? If somebody, any job that you do, you should get paid for it, in my view.
Well, I also think that it's a responsibility of somebody who listens to the music to support the artist. I think that's an exchange that should happen. People I see do it all the time at shows when they buy something from the artist, be it a piece of vinyl or whatever.
Right.
I was sort of speaking of artistic expression, the ability for me to, I could do this. I could be a 14-year-old kid and go to Spotify and then I hear this song. Right, I'm not paying anything for it, but I'll hear, I'm going to let this play a minute.
Yeah. We're heading apart.
He's getting there, right? He's getting
there. In the city. Yeah.
We're listening to John Prine from his first album. And more powerful words. So beautiful. Here we go.
We had an apartment in the city. Me and Loretta like living there. Well, it'd been years since the kids had grown a life of their own and left us alone. John and Linda live in Omaha. Joe is somewhere on the road. We lost Davy in the Korean War, and I still don't know what for. Don't matter anymore. You know that old trees just grow stronger, and old rivers grow wilder every day. Old people just grow lonesome, waiting for someone to say hello in there.
So I guess my point is that, without dismissing your point, is simply that the ability to hear things and be touched by music is easier than ever. And the ability for, I mean, if John Prine was, well, he is making music today, but if the young John Prine, L.A. Salami is an artist that Robin Hilton played for us recently from the U.K., politically very wise artist, and I could turn him on and listen and never pay a dime. I understand that he may never get paid much more than a dime, but I think there is a freedom as an artist to express yourself more and more. And there are many, many more middle-class artists who just play small clubs going around making a living that way, too.
So. Well, you may be right, but I think the idea of not paying... Now, I'll stop talking about this because it gets boring, but the idea that you don't pay young artists for the work that they do eventually will discourage them from doing the work. They will find other ways of using their time and do other things, and that would be extremely remiss. I promise you this, when I was a young man, if I hadn't got paid, I got paid very little to start with, but if I hadn't been paid, if there wasn't that idea that if I did really good work and worked my balls off 24 fucking hours a day, and that I wouldn't get remunerated for it, and there wasn't a possibility that I might make quite a lot of money, I think it would have been a very different situation. Mm. Yeah. You know, if you put this model into other commerce, it just, we all know that it wouldn't work. You say, well, you know, bananas are free. You could just walk into a shop. Everything is free. You just go in and take it. You take it out and you take it away. Well, hang on a minute. Why is it free? Because we're selling Volkswagens. But what happens to the people who are growing the bananas? in some third world country whose living it is to go to tend the trees, to go out with a machete, to cut the bananas, to pack them up, to box them. What happens to them if you don't pay anything for them? They're screwed. They can't make a living then. They have nothing. There's nothing more than. And so it's all very well if you've got some middlemen sitting at computers saying, we don't give a shit about the people who grow the bananas. We couldn't care less about them. All we care about is selling soap. And we can make a good living selling soap, so screw them. Well, it's wrong. That's all. It's wrong.
And we'll be right back right after this.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Blue Headphones. For 20 years, your favorite artists have used Blue microphones in the studio. Now, Blue's radical headphone design lets you hear new details in your favorite music. Find out why Esquire magazine called them the perfect headphones. Visit the store at blue-headphones.com and use coupon code NPR for a special price. Blue, carpe eardrum.
You know, when we listening to all the music that we played and the Sam Cooke and the other tunes, I tried to imagine you hearing that for the first time. And what you must have thought, and I guess I was wondering, I wonder if there was ever a moment when you realized that you wanted to make music that mattered on a deeper level.
You know, I don't choose, I've used this analogy often before, I don't choose what I paint. It's like, it's very, very difficult to write a song or to paint a picture. And I think people who do it, whose work we may admire, like John Prine, he doesn't one day sit down and think, I know I'm going to write a song about old people and what it must be like to be ignored in old age and the connections between people. He wrote that song after he was spent a summer delivering laundry to old people's homes, and he would sit and talk to some of the old folk before. And so it's an expression of some love that he felt in his life. And maybe all great work stems from love. And from the ability to love. And John Prine, by the way, I hardly could listen to your question just now because I was thinking about John. Either yesterday or next Monday, and I can't remember which, it was either the 10th or the 17th. He's 70 years old. So happy birthday, yeah. Brother, if you ever hear this. I wish I could be there in Nashville with you on one of those days, but I'm doing these gigs out in the desert and it'd be a bit tricky. I digressed.
No, that's fine. When I saw that Newport Folk Festival show, and I'm going to say I've listened to you a long time, and I'm an old guy and spent many years listening to music. The connection, although I worked in record stores when John Prine's first record came out and when your records were coming out, I never made a connection between what you do and sing about and what he does and sing about, because in my brain, I said, oh, John's got a twang and he's this and he's that, and you've got this, like, just this beast of a music behind you, and it's grand, and it's, but it's boiled down to a simplicity, as I saw it at Newport Folk, and you sang a John Prine song, if I'm not mistaken.
I sang that song.
It's the same music.
You know what? In that song, and in almost every John Prine song, he addresses one of the central economic question of all of our lives. When he says the line, we lost Davy in the Korean War, and we still don't know what for. You know, if you look at the body of his work, and not just Sam Stone and what's the song about Donald and Lydia, all those songs about army life and war and the deprivations, blah, blah, blah. But if you listen to it, he's constantly asking the question, what are we doing this for? Why are we in a state of perpetual war? And it's a very, very important question, and it is one that is not being addressed by the people of the United States of America or, by and large, the people anywhere. But it's fundamentally important because it is destroying the planet. It's destroying our hearts. It's destroying many people's lives physically. If you look at the Middle East now, and particularly Syria just at the moment, people are being destroyed, their lives are being destroyed, and nobody knows why. You know, there's a line in my song Us and Them which goes, at the end of the song it goes, with, without, and who'll deny that's what the fighting's all about. And I was listening to it the other day. That's why my new tour next year is going to be called Us and Them. It's specifically about that line. Because the answer to the question, who'll deny that's what the fighting's all about, is this. Almost everyone.
Yeah.
Almost everyone will deny that with without is what the fighting's all about. My contention is that it is. Most people think that the fighting is about the fact that we are right and they are wrong. Most people think that war's about ideology. It's about if only they could learn to live the way we do and be democratic, and if only they could change, if only they could become better, everything would be all. That's not what it's about. Mm. You know, it's quite clear to anyone with half a brain that there is no us and them. We are all us. We're all human beings first. Our nationalities should not even be in the first five items of importance in our lives. Nationality is a track that we march down unthinkingly, and it leads us nowhere.
And play a little music.
It can't be helped that there's a lot of it about. Without.
Out of the way, it's a busy day, I've got things on my mind is also incredibly relevant, I feel. I feel, you know, we're so in this, all of us are in this together, but I have never been made to feel more like it's a us and them than I have this past year or so.
It's the stock in trade of politicians in a failing political environment to introduce the them as the raison d'etre for their political power. That's what Trump's doing. So he points at the Mexicans and he points at the Chinese and he points at the anybody who is not us, i.e. not American, becomes their, or one of our acolytes becomes them. And then everything is easy, because you can say the fact that you are feeling defeated and the middle class in America are feeling defeated, and they are on the brink of defeat. I mean, their standard of living has dropped over the last 20 years, and they no longer have the freedoms guaranteed them under the Bill of Rights that they used to have. Since 9/11, you know, with 2021 and the amendments to the Patriot Act, you, as citizens of the United States, no longer have the basic freedoms that you had before. You can no longer even appeal to habeas corpus. If the government decides that you or me maybe are in some way helping something that they define as terrorist, and it could be anything, and people have tried to take the government to court to find out what these parameters are, but you can be taken off the streets and incarcerated forever with no access to a phone call or a lawyer or your family or anything. And that is now part of the law of this land, and it is horrific, and it slides by without anybody noticing at all, except if you just say to people, what do you think about that? They go, well, we have to stop them terrorists. Well, that's just dumb. That is so dumb. Mm-hmm. What, is it not an act of terrorism to be able to incarcerate somebody without trial forever? This is the actions of a completely totalitarian police state. And they've done it, obviously, a lot in Guantanamo with foreign nationals, which, by the way, President Obama, you have 100 days left. You said you were going to close Guantanamo in, immediately. You've got 100 days left to fulfill that promise. And I suggest you should do it. I mean, maybe he won't be able to. We don't know what goes on behind the locked doors in the corridors of power. But it, what a great gift that would be to the world and to the American people. What a huge gift to the American people to say, we no longer wish to be the torturers of innocent brown people who we picked up off the streets of Karachi and who have had not a single opportunity to say, actually, I didn't do it. And would it not be reasonable for us to have to prove that they did it or even come up with any evidence at all that these people are guilty of anything except having been turned in for $20 by somebody who wanted the $20 who lives down the street? It's it's absolutely disgusting what's been done in Guantanamo Bay to a lot of innocent people. I'm not saying there might not be have been one or two bad apples. And if there are, well, then try them in a military and or a civilian court. Probably a civilian tribunal might be the best way of doing it.
With all the passion that you have and you're about to take your music on the road, how do you take this message? And you do it so well in your music, but how do you take it in front of people and it doesn't come off as something that people want to go and just see as entertainment? Like, you know what I mean? Like, so much of what you do can just be looked at as, oh, let's get stoned and watch, you know, whatever visuals are going to come and amaze us. Like, how do you take the message and really make it less about just you and audience, but some sort of action, some sort of action?
You know, the commercial reality of all our lives was kind of enshrined at maybe the turn of the century or maybe before, but certainly the when we turned into the 20th century, the J.P. Morgans and, you know, and the Vanderbilts and people decided that commerce was really the model upon which we should base all of our lives, and that a free-ish market would make everything great for everybody forever. And it's a fallacy. It doesn't. But it's something that over the years we've come to accept and we've come to buy. I think now, beneath the surface of walking out, I live in New York, you walk out into the streets, there are people bumping into you, young people as well, bumping into you because they're fiddling around with their iPhone instead of looking where they're going. You know, it's the most bizarre thing. And they come to rock concerts as well, and they don't watch the concert, they watch their iPhone. And then in the middle of it, they'll be tweeting their friends saying, hey, I'm at Rajawari's concert. Look, isn't it groovy? I want to drag them out onto the stage and slap them and say, what the f*** is wrong with you? You know, why can't you enjoy the moment? Be here. Be here now. Listen to John Prine singing. Don't take a crappy movie of him. So what, there's now 10 million movies of, you know, of some show that all look like crap because they're all on your iPhone. The only reason that you think they're groovy is because it's yours. So it's a sort of sinking into the pit of solipsism. I think there is a hunger now for a path to open up or a space to open up in front of people that's not full of iPhones, but where they can actually be allowed the information to see what the potential for their lives is, and to see that maybe there is space for love rather than commerce in their lives. And maybe there's a possibility that we could organize our society so that we helped each other, and not just each other in this country, not just to educate our children so we at least get an educated electorate, but to help people in other countries in the world to recognize that this is a very small, fragile planet, and we will destroy it if we don't start cooperating with one another. And in order for that cooperation to work, the very rich, advanced, developed countries are going to help the less developed countries. Otherwise, we are going to remain in a state of conflict and until everyone is dead, and it will not take very long. The estimates are maybe 100 years, maybe less. So it is absolutely beholden upon this generation of young people to push the iPhones to one side and focus on whether or not they have the capacity to love their brothers and sisters. And if they do, well, then now they have to organize and do something about it. We're seeing things beginning to happen, like the Black Lives Matter, for instance, is extremely important movement in this country. Okay, we had the civil rights thing and we arrived at a point, but then it went, oh, well, that's all over. It's not all over. It is not all over. We have only just scratched the surface. But there's all kinds of things that need to be done to make your society not racist. You have to reform the prison system. You've got to start, you know, the incarceration of millions and millions of people is not a good model for society. It makes profits for the people who own the prisons, and they're privately owned now. More people who are incarcerated, the more money they make. It's good business. It's paid for by the taxpayer. The taxpayer pays for everything. The taxpayer pays, you know, nearly $1 trillion a year to go and kill brown people in other countries. Well, it's wrong. That $1 trillion a year should be used for looking after poor people in this country, developing your infrastructure, starting to educate people, providing free healthcare, all the things that developed countries do if they're not brainwashed into spending it all on nuclear weapons or F-16s or stealth bombers or whatever, or very, very expensive ordnance so that people can make big profits out of it. I know I sound like a crazy person, but I'm not. I'm actually a wise man, and people would do. And there are many, many, many very wise people in this country, but they are kept out of the mainstream media by and large. And if these wise people, Jeffrey Sachs is a great example. You know who started the whole Millennium Promise thing? Wanting to get rid of extreme poverty globally. And for a moment there, he was the darling of the media. You would see him on MSNBC. He was one of the talking heads. And then he started to say stuff that was inconveniently true. And you don't see him now. He's disappeared off the radar. He's still a very wise and humane man. But his voice has been kind of silenced. If you don't toe the party line and say what they want you to say, you get edged into the sidelines. It's insidious. And it's very, very dangerous as well. I would make Jeffrey Sachs president of this country tomorrow. And I'd have Bernie Sanders as the vice president. And I think they'd do a really good job. Unfortunately, my one vote doesn't count for much. Actually, I don't even have a vote.
You don't have, yeah. I was going to say.
Yeah. You paint such a dire picture, and but I'm wondering if there's room in your personal narrative for hope.
Of course there is. Yeah. I'm one of the most hopeful people that you will ever meet. In fact, I wrote an opera about the French Revolution called Ça Ira, which is the future tense of ça va, so it means that will be, essentially. But I always subtitle it, There is Hope. I'm a great believer that eventually reason will descend on us again, and that we will understand that the systems that we've come to adopt and to use are criminally insane, and that they are inhuman, and that they are not the life we really want. We really want a life where we can bring up our children in peace and safety, and where everyone else in the world can bring up their children in peace and safety as well, where our children can be educated, where they can fulfill their whole potential, all of them, not just the ones who go to Harvard and Yale, but all our children can fulfill their absolute potential. Not just their potential to become intellectually competent, but their potential to express the love that they were born with for other human beings, and to make the world habitable, which at the moment it is not. And we are going to destroy all human life very quickly if we don't figure out a new way to organize things. And we should start with the armaments industry, and with what Dwight D. Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, Because he warned us in 1966 that this was going to happen, and he was right.
56,
sorry. And he was absolutely right, and his warnings went unheeded. And so policy, by and large, in the United States is now governed. I'm not suggesting a conspiracy that people get together behind a locked door and decide what's happening, but by and large, policy is decided by the big corporations, the armaments industries, the CIA and the Pentagon, maybe the FBI as well, the NSA. It's weird. It's a bit like the Matrix, you know. They have taken over. And although it's, as I say, I'm not suggesting that it's a Machiavellian plot that has been put in place by specific people for specific reasons. Nevertheless, they write policy, and it's a dreadful policy. It's inhumane. People are miserable living under this system. They kind of look happy, but, you know, or some of them do. A lot of them don't, obviously. But if we read Wells, for instance, if you go back to The Time Traveler, you know, the Eloi looked happy as well. They didn't realize. The Eloi, for anyone who doesn't know in The Time Traveler, they're the kind of sweet, jolly people who are pottering around, you know, watching football games on their iPhones, but beneath the surface of the Morlocks, who are actually living off them, and you discover later on in the story that the Eloi are actually food. They're just fodder, and they're being fed on by this insidious and very dangerous machine that is just beneath the surface. And it's not a bad picture of what's going on.
After listening to you just now, I was thinking, well, I can't wait for the next record.
How does that translate? Yeah. Anyway,
so thank you so much.
And thanks for the...
Not at all. It's been a great pleasure being here. Thank you for having me.
Cheers. Roger Waters, his new upcoming tour is called Us and Them. Look forward to a new album from him in the near future. I'm Bob Boylan, along with Robin Hilton. For NPR Music, it's All Songs Considered. A little epilogue. If you're a Pink Floyd fan, we had a conversation yesterday with Joe Boyd, who witnessed and was part of the scene in London in 66 when Pink Floyd was playing out live. It's a fascinating conversation about the early days of the band. And later in the week, Nick Mason, the drummer of Pink Floyd, talks about those early years because there's a new collection that's out. It's called Pink Floyd Early Years, 1965 to 1972. So we'll talk to Nick Mason about those days. Subscribe to the podcast to get them downloaded to your little device.